welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. And brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and thank you for joining me as we celebrate 500 Listen to Older Voices programs. Last week was the 500th program, and it seemed fitting to interview the woman who was responsible for starting Listen to Older Voices, and was indeed its first producer and co-presenter, Hannah Skye. In this part two of a three-part program featuring Hannah, we learn of her experiences at Monash University during its heady political years of the late 60s, early 70s. On becoming a teacher, Hannah was posted to the last Strap School in Victoria, where she took a stand, which was not the last time she took a stand on behalf of underrepresented people. We learn about her community development work and how she was instrumental in the Melba Project commencing and through that, the formation and development of this great radio program, Listen to Older Voices. We pick up with me discussing what life in a boarding school was like for Hannah. Was it an all-girls?
It's an all-girls school.
Well, it is very much like a convent almost, with it.
Oh, yeah.
Minus the nuns.
Yeah. It was always very difficult by year. We had two social events. In 6 years, you had two social events. So when you're in year 11, there was a school dance. And it was very problematic for the boarders because we didn't know any boys.
No.
We only knew each other's brothers.
Yes.
Or some of the day girls' brothers we were friendly with. And so, you know, it was quite a challenge to, you know, find a boy that you could actually invite.
Indeed. And I guess being, if I might use the term, locked up like that, I guess even your social skills of actually mixing with boys that age must have been pretty rudimentary.
Oh, shocking.
Clumsy even.
You'd be surprised that given that I ended up doing radio and I've done a lot of teaching, quite a lot of public presentation. One of my jobs at the moment is doing fire-ready presentations with the CFA. I came out of that place absolutely so shy, and I went to Monash University. I was living in residence at Monash, and the warden, I think they called them, the warden, the person who oversaw the houses of residence, he insisted that we all went to the common room after our evening meal, and we were meant to socially interact. Somebody told me at the end of the year that this whole group of them used to lay bets on whether I'd get over the five-minute mark of staying there and talking to people. And I do remember it as an absolute agony.
Well, you can understand why.
Because I just didn't know how to talk to people anymore.
Now, it's interesting that you went to Monash, because if there was a hotbed of almost political insurrection in the late 60s, early 70s, it was Monash.
Oh, it was all happening at Monash.
Was it happening while you were there?
Yes, it was. Oh, yeah, Albert Langer.
Good old
the
Albert.
The whole, you know, the Springbok tours, the Vietnam moratoriums.
Yes.
There was the time when Monash conferred an honorary degree on Henry Bolte. We all got very stirred up about that. My other memory at Monash, actually, is when the first moon landing at Monash then. They'd set televisions up all around the student union. We all packed in there and watched that.
So you've got this young woman who, as a child, was really outgoing. She mixed with her brothers. She mixed with the boys and the girls around town, did everything. Suddenly finds herself locked up in this very closeted environment, comes out of that as a very shy woman. How did you mix with boys? Did you find that difficult, and how did you overcome that difficulty?
After my first year at Monash, I actually changed halls of residence, and I decided I just had to start talking to people, or life wasn't going to be worthwhile. So I did just made myself start talking to people. But I think really at the start of, I did a bit better that year. In second year, I'd gone into the honours stream, and there was only a small group, there were only 14 of us. So that was a smaller group, you know, you got to know people.
Yes.
So that was very different for me. And then at the start of third year, I actually moved out the halls of residence. And when I started, I lived in a house that was bulging at the seams with young adults, a terrace house in Elizabeth Street in Prahran, which it led into the Prahran Market. So it was very different. So it meant I was in a household of young people, so, you know, people my own age. And it was a different type, you know, it was more community, you know, got me back to, like, I didn't go to all the big concerts and things like that that were happening around that time, because I still, for years, in fact, you know, to go to things with lots of people, I found very difficult. I was very much through those years, 69, 70, 71, living in various households around Prahran and so on, and involved in those households with other people I met, networks. I was building up sort of social networks, right, but on a smaller scale.
So where did you focus your life when you left study? What did you move into?
I was there at Monash for 5 years. I did a four-year degree, and then for my last year I did a dip ed. And you could, the education department would pay for your dip ed if you did a year. They could send you wherever they liked.
Right.
So in 1972 I got sent to the last strap school in the state.
Now, so the last trap school...
The real strap school. Yeah, yeah. When my head of department showed me my desk, he opened the drawer and showed there's my strap, regulation strap, rolled up, sitting on the top drawer. And I was the only, it was a big school, about 1,200 kids there, and I was the only teacher who didn't use a strap or wouldn't have a good student strap. So that was a pretty exciting year. And I learnt to get a bit, that toughened me up. I was a bit politically savvy there. I had a bit of fun. At one stage, the head of the trades department pulled a couple of kids out of my classroom for no good reason that I could see and strapped them.
Listen to Older Voices, where stories from the past find a home in the present.
And so I rang up one of the old education department inspectors who had actually previously been my tutor when I was doing my dip ed, and asked him what my rights were, etc., and got very clear about it and took on this head of department. They couldn't believe it at the school, this little first-year female teacher. Anyway, I took him on and he was made to formally apologise, and so it didn't happen. You know, they didn't strap my kids after that.
Did that make life difficult for you?
Oh, yeah, they were very hostile.
Yes.
Staff were very hostile. Not all of them, but a lot of them were. But it made it easy from the point of view of the kids. You know, for the rest of the year I'd have these, you know, little year seven girls would come up and they'd have these welts up the side of their legs and they'd say, look, miss, and I'd say, well, legally they're not allowed to do that to you. You could tell your parents, show them. But a lot of these kids came from the Housing Commission homes in Ballarat. Their parents are really struggling and wouldn't have understood their children's rights, even if they had, you know, they don't have
even if
time,
they understood,
can't get up to the school.
And probably not even the comfortability in confronting a teacher like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I left. I only stayed there a year.
And then you moved in, kept with teaching, or did you move on?
Yeah, I went overseas for some months. Came back, did a bit of teaching, and the most interesting teaching I did was at Diamond Creek Tech, which under the Whitlam government had been set up to explore progressive education. So there was Huntingdale Tech, Swinburne Tech and Diamond Creek Tech. We're all looking at innovative education. And I was lucky enough to work with two other teachers. We team taught and we took the core innovative program at Diamond Creek Tech. That was a fantastic experience. I stayed there for about 5 years and I'd been learning Tai Chi at this stage and I had health issues. So I left teaching and took to teaching Tai Chi. And I freelanced as a Tai Chi and movement teacher for about 12 years, including a couple of years teaching Tai Chi at the Vic College of the Arts to the entire School of Drama.
Right.
Can claim to talk Tai Chi to people like Vince Colosimo.
That's a claim.
And stopped that when I had my son, Wirin, and then in the when he was about four, as soon as he started kinder or prep or whatever it was, there was a job going in Healesville for a project. They wanted a project officer for an open learning project. And I did that. And while I was doing that, Sandra Poppins, who's very well known in this area for having done all sorts of fantastic work, she worked with what were originally Outer Eastern TAFE and now Swinburne, and Sandra was behind the creation of UNA, the Indigenous Education and Cultural Centre. And Sandra was on my steering committee, and she said to me that the Victorian Women's Trust, they were calling for submissions. And in those days, you know, heady days in the early 90s, where organisations like the Women's Trust had quite a bit of money, they're putting money into seeding grants. You know, it was a great time in community development, very creative time. So Sandra said to me, why don't you think about a project that uses similar technologies to the ones that I was promoting in this open learning project, but a community-based project. Well, I had been working with the primary schools, the high school, Healesville Education Unit, and some other education-based organisations, and we'd been getting computers into the primary schools. The local primary schools didn't have computers at that stage.
No.
Or if they had them, they were still in the cupboard because they didn't know what to do with them.
No, you had worked them, that's right.
It was called the Melbourne Open Learning Project. We also set up hands-free phones in each of the primary schools in the catchment area. And I negotiated with Healesville High School. There was a big push towards LOAT, languages other than English. And the primary schools, it was quite difficult for them to fulfil this demand that they provide a language other than English. So I negotiated between the high school and the primary schools, and Healesville High School gave Japanese lessons via these hands-free telephones to the primary schools, because they're very little, some of these schools, so you could cluster a whole class of grade 5 and 6, and only be, you know, half a dozen of them, around the phone. And then, and we had, and Yumiko, who was a native speaker, would, once a month, she would go to the school and do some face-to-face talking with the kids. Anyway, in the whole process of negotiating with what I think were Telecom back then, around, you know, the hands-free phones and stuff, I had heard for the first time about telelinking.
Right.
So when Sandra said to me, think of a community project, immediately came into my head those elderly people I'd known as a kid, those isolated elderly people in their Nissen huts and shacks in the bush. And I thought, well, these days most of them, you know, well, they don't exist in Patton Hill anymore because all their shacks were burnt in
the
62 fires and they weren't rebuilt. But their equivalent these days would probably, most of them would have phones. And if they didn't, it might be possible to get phones to them. So I did some research around telelinking to see if anybody had done anything, and I discovered a woman in Brisbane who was using telelinking to provide support to people with chronic psychiatric illness.
All right.
And then I went and I discovered that the Department of Agriculture at that stage had sitting within it the Rural Women's Network. So I rang them up and went along to a meeting with them. I met with Anna Lotkovitz and Janet, his name I can't remember, who were the project workers, and a fabulous pair of women. It was a fabulous thing, the Rural Women's Network. It still is going. It's a slightly different form, and it sits in the Department of Planning and Community Development now. And they invited me to present this idea of telelinking isolated elderly women to their reference group. And I did that, and I was subsequently invited to join the reference group, and I was on it for years. They also helped me with the networking, and I went along to Council on the Ageing, got support from them, support from the Rural Women's Reference Group, submitted to the Vic Women's Trust, and got $4,000. And so I spent We called it the Melbourne Support to Isolated Women. And I spent a number of months going around local organisations, talking to them about how we wanted to set up this telelinking to support isolated elderly women, trying to get referrals. But
right.
Most of the local organisations thought this was a fly-by-night thing. They were reluctant to refer. At the same time, I wanted somebody with a social work background, which I didn't have, to work with me. And I approached Mary Robertson. It was the best thing I ever did. Mary and I worked together for 12 years, and she was a dream to work with. A woman of huge integrity and so competent, worked so well with people. The most thorough and compassionate person you could come across. And Mary and I, you know, started a partnership there. At the same time, Di Moore, I approached Di and I said, look, we need some referrals. We've got the money. Let's get this project going. Di Moore, who you would know was a counsellor here for many years, Di gave us some referrals. And I also just started, when I saw elderly women I knew on the street of Yarra Glen or whatever, I'd go and say, do you know? Who do you know? And in no time, we had our first telelink up and running.
You're tuned to Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Hannah Skye, the creator of Listen to Older Voices, as we commemorate its 500th program.
That was September 92. We started the first telelink. And in 1994, there was a woman called Pat Beale at Healesville Living and Learning Centre. And the Melbourne Urban Learning Project had been housed at Healesville Living and Learning Centre, or an auspice by it. And so the Melbourne Support to Isolated Women stayed there. They were happy to, you know, keep us there. And they had a community development worker there, Pat Beale. And Pat and I were talking one day, and we decided that we'd put in to the DHS, Department of Human Services, for HAC, that's Home and Community Care funding, for the project. Because when Mary and I had been working for 18 months on this $4,000, we're still working on this same $4,000.
You can only stretch it so far.
That's right. So Pat and I put together a submission and they gave us $5,000. So we had that, and in 1995 I was contacted by Alison Beckett, who was the community liaison officer at that time for HAC, because they'd just sent us the money. We'd had no contact really, and I didn't even realise that they had given us recurrent funding. And so we had this conversation in which she realised that they had made no contact with us. So I was putting in all our stats, you know, the number of women and the number of hours, which we're doing on this incredible shoestring. And she was extremely impressed with how cost-effective it was. And she actually, it was nominated as a model of good practice. And I thought, oh, here's an in. And I applied for some one-off funding. I'd always been interested in radio, and I also applied for funding to run a second telephone social club, because the telephone social club was fantastic. It worked so well. Women loved it.
How have you been? I've called a million times.
This is Listen to Older Voices, featuring issues and information.
A telephone, that sort of connection is a great way of linking people. It's so intimate. Mm. Talking on the phone is intimate. It's something that women do. It was years before we got a man to join, because it's not really that men mostly use, particularly that generation, mostly use the phone just to order things, for practical
business.
Things. Yeah,
business. Yes, yes.
Whereas women use it to communicate
socially,
and
yes.
help to families and, you know, that sort of thing. But because you're listening, you know, the voice is right there in your ear and you can hear so much. You know yourself when you talk to somebody, but somebody you know well, a child, a spouse, whatever, you can tell immediately if they're tired, if they're happy, if they're depressed
yes.
from their voice. And Mary and Iris Caddy, who was a volunteer, they were very skilled at being able to tell if a woman was actually, there was something going
underlying,
wrong.
Underlying,
so we were able to, and they'd ring back after the link or go round there. And we often were able to avert potential crises in those
yes.
women's lives. So it was very effective in that way. So we wanted to be able to actually start another one. We also thought, Mary and I, that it might work as a way of linking carers who were... There was very little funding for or support for carers in those days, and we thought this might be a way that carers could have some sort of a support group. So I put in for funding, do a feasibility study on using the telelinking for carers and also for the radio station. Now, part of developing that submission for that one-off funding was that I went to the local senior citizens club, I went to the Probus groups, and I spoke to them about my belief that a radio program would allow us to raise people's understanding of ageing, to raise the profile of aged people. I felt very strongly and spoke to those senior citizens groups and those Probus clubs and so on about the idea that how can you possibly have a healthy community when members of that community think that to age is to be on the scrap heap?
Yes.
If we think we're heading for the scrap heap, how do we value our own lives, you know? And as you would know yourself, it's only in quite recent times that in our community we've understood again that the aged have a huge amount to offer us, that in life experience there is wisdom, that that's innate in life experience. I think there was a whole period of time there, particularly through the sort of the heady capitalistic days of the 80s, or I should say consumeristic days of the 80s, where if you weren't seen as a mainstream consumer, somebody, you know, who could buy goods and participate in all that sort of stuff, you had no value.
Join me next week for the third and final part of my talk with Hannah Sky, when Hannah acknowledges and talks about the many people who contributed to the Listen to Older Voices program development and about some of the people who appeared on the program. That's next week on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.